Welcome to the Financial Markets Insight podcast brought to you by the Realization Group, where we bring together the best minds in the capital markets and financial industry to discuss the trends and news. My name is George Aliferis, I'll be your host today, and I have the pleasure to discuss with Alan Veer, Project and Program Manager for Brink & Dunn, a leading consultancy for the financial industry, and we're going to discuss the $200 or $300 trillion question of the transition to IBOR. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you very much.
First of all, I'd like to bring people on board who may not be fully familiar with what's going on. Can you give us the big picture and why do we need to transition to IBOR? What has been happening so far?
Oh, sure. So I guess it's been a long-running saga. Back in 2008, the financial crisis exposed that LIBOR wasn't really representative for the marketplace, and in fact exaggerated the impacts of the financial crisis. And secondly, LIBOR was and it could be and was manipulated by some of the group responsible for setting that rate. So early in 2012, it was decided that LIBOR submissions should be based on actual trades. And it was this report that effectively started the transition to the new reference rates, such that in 2017, the FCA announced that from the end of 2021, they would no longer compel banks to submit LIBOR marks. So at that point, that is effectively the end of LIBOR, is no longer representative as something to mark your positions against.
And yes, from my years in the financial industry, this is quite a big deal because everything was benchmark to LIBOR or plus 3 months. It seems like the whole rates industry was based on that.
I think probably it's worth pointing out at this point that what we're talking about here is the migration of legacy trade. The new reference rates that replace LIBOR have been used for a long time now. So most of the system's work to be able to trade these instruments is done. This is about the migration of all of those LIBOR positions that we currently have on our books. So how do we get those from being LIBOR to the new reference rates? So that's really what this has been about at the end of last year and the middle of 2023 for US dollar.
This is what has been achieved so far. Can you expand a bit into that?
Yeah, so I guess the first transition was targeted at the end of 2021. So the publication of four LIBOR for four major currencies, so sterling, Swissie, euro and yen, ceased. So at that point in time, we needed something to replace LIBOR, and there were ready-made risk-free rates, RFR, in place to replace them. I think that was the main rush at the end of last year, making sure all of our systems were ready for those replacement RFRs, because this was the first transition. So that was the first milestone. I guess the next milestone we have is the equivalent process for US dollars. So theoretically, I guess, if we look at all of our systems, we prepared them well for the non-US dollar transitions. They should be pretty much prepared for the US dollar transitions that happen in the middle of next year. But there are subtle differences. So there are products that we won't have prepared for with the non-US dollars. And also just the sheer volume of the US dollar market means that we need to retest processes, we need to retest performance for that go live in June 2023. Beyond that, there are still more transitions, right? Although US dollar is the big transition in the middle of next year, after that, we have the sort of Canadian dollar, we have Singapore dollar. So there are smaller currencies to come thereafter. But if we can nail US dollar this year, the work is substantially complete.
So we're going to dive into what needs to be done regarding this transition. But first, I'd be really interested to hear about your background and what brought you into this position.
So my background is reasonably varied. I've started off in accountancy, moved through programming, trading, systems ownership. But now my current role is that of sort of project and program manager for Brink & Dunn. And I've performed since 2014, everything from sort of getting impetus into projects to multi-year programs of work. So we've been working very closely with organizations on IBOR. So we understand the challenges that banks have faced over that non-US dollar transition. And we're really just looking to make sure that everyone is prepared for the US dollar transition. So my role is to make sure those preparations are in place.
And you mentioned the banks have to make significant changes. What are the types of institutions that you're dealing with at Brinkendon?
Yeah, so the institutions that we deal with are primarily the larger banks. So this would be the national banks for different countries, as well as those big multinational organizations as well. But that doesn't mean to say that we don't have an understanding of the impacts for smaller organizations, because our work so far with some of those larger banks has given us an insight into what the smaller organizations are facing as well, and the difficulties they face, because they are the key counterparts of those bigger organizations. So we tend to see it from both sides.
So now, if we go back to this transition, perhaps one good starting point is to see how it affects the different types of players. Can you give us their perspective?
I think for larger organizations, the primary challenge here is the client outreach. So they will have a large number of clients. Not all of those clients will have signed up to the fallback protocols. That's part of the process by which trades no longer address the old eyeball rates. They now address the RFRs. So from a larger bank's perspective, it is about sort of client outreach, making sure that we've discussed with clients what we're going to do with those trades that they have, what the options are.
And you mentioned fallback protocols. So is that what happens if people decide to not act upon it? Or how does everyone have to make a decision regarding the transition?
Okay, all banks are going to be impacted by the transition to some degree or another. The fallback itself is embedded within the ISDA protocol. So the ISDA protocol is something that every participant in the market either signed up to or didn't sign up to. Now, if you've signed up to that protocol, you have the means to reprice your eyeball trades using the protocol's detail. So the protocol will give you the step-by-step detail to reprice your position against the new RFR rate rather than LIBOR. Theoretically, I guess, if you've got a swap that prices against LIBOR currently, and both you and your counterpart have signed up to the ISDA protocol and the fallback process, then really there isn't a great deal to do for that trade. You can leave that trade on your books, and as long as you have the mechanism to reprice it using the RFR, it's job done. Now, there is some subtlety to that. The RFR-based fallback formula is more computationally intensive. You are going to face, I guess, performance issues revaluing all of those trades using the fallback methodologies. So that's the key issue with that. But and also for other trades that are leveraging the fallback, such as CCP trades as well, they will be converted for you by the CCPs. If you've signed up to the protocol, your work is much easier. If you haven't signed up to the protocol, then unfortunately, your trade doesn't need to be renegotiated with your clients. And that tends to have a reasonably long lead time while you discuss how the trade can be restructured, how it's going to continue to meet the original objectives of that trade, and that it is equitable to both parties.
Yes, so that now we understand, I think, much better the challenge. So basically, as a firm, I've got all those trades in my books, and they can be from many years ago, and they were all based on the old LIBOR. And now, for example, even if I have a fallback mechanism, first I have to calculate, and secondly, it means a different kind of price, and therefore all the consequence that goes with it. Is that a good summary?
It is, because I think that the reason that they calculate differently is that LIBOR was a forward-looking rate, whereas the new RFRs are effectively a backward-looking rate. They're using historic trade rates. So all of those models need to change. But those models will have been changed already. Those models will already be used for trading those new RFRs today. So in that respect, the update of the model is part of the business-as-usual process. Because where we're now concentrating our fire really is around this transition of legacy trades. So how do we take all of those trades that are sitting on our books at the moment and A, reprice them, B, revalue them on an ongoing basis as well, or if they won't transition naturally, then what do? We reach out to the clients. How do we renegotiate a replacement? It's those sort of things. So it's quite a well-understood process that we need to apply, but nevertheless, it's going to take time.
And there's no option of doing nothing.
If you do nothing, let's think about what happened if you did nothing in the non-US dollar transition that we had at the end of last year. So for sterling and yen, the regulators put in place a sort of a synthetic product that meant for all of those trades that you weren't able to transition, either because your fallback process didn't work properly or your negotiations with clients were incomplete, you had this sort of synthetic process to fall back on. You don't really have that for US dollar yet. So they haven't said there is going to be a synthetic lock that will remain for a year, let's say, after the demise of US dollar live proper. The other things that are going to happen, the CCP transitions are going to happen regardless. So the CCP will be looking at your trades and will be converting those trades. So that is a cancellation of all of your old trades and rebooking of a brand new trade that references the RFRs. They will be doing that on a set date, come what may. So you need to understand whether you are sufficiently comfortable with their processes and the impact of their processes on you to ignore the dress rehearsal options they give you. So that will happen regardless. On a certain date, middle of May next year, the CCPs will transition. I guess one of the big risks is that you've carried forward workarounds from the non-US dollar transitions that haven't been properly resolved yet. So the question you need to ask is, will these workarounds hold up under the new increased US dollar volumes? And I guess you need to really need to make sure that you complete those client conversations in 2022 as well. To let that slip any later will make things really difficult for you.
Could you give us a bigger picture of the steps that firms need to take in order to successfully complete this transition and avoid all the risks that you mentioned?
So I think the first thing you need to do is identify the trades that need to be transitioned. And broadly speaking, you're going to categorize those in as one, trades that can leverage the fallback, and two, those that you'll need to renegotiate with the client. So for the latter, the sort of renegotiated trade, this will cause the biggest problems, and the banks need to pick up the phone to the clients and renegotiate a replacement trade as soon as possible. As I said, the renegotiated trade needs to fit the original purpose and be equitable. And this is going to take some time. Most banks have this underway, but really you need to be on top of this by the end of quarter one next year at the very latest. There is, at the moment, as we said, there is no safety net. There is no sort of synthetic US dollar LIBOR that is going to carry you forward beyond the middle of June 23. So you've got to get this right. And that is by far the biggest problem. You're going to be picking up the phone to a corporate client, and they are perhaps not going to understand what is happening to that trade, what is happening to LIBOR, and probably will be looking to push back against having a perfectly adequate hedge replaced by something that isn't quite a perfect fit. So that's a big piece of work just there. I think for the former of those two points, those trades that can leverage the fallback, then there is a much more predictable set of work items that we need to walk through.
So timing is an issue, but I could imagine there's an issue of resources and allocating those resources, those sales teams, instead of doing their, whatever conversation.
Yeah.
They have to have specific conversation and they have to solve this problem.
And they have to know what the options are to replace those products as well. So if your client has bought a five-year swap, what are you going to offer to replace it with, and how equitable is that going to feel to your client? You've got to have these in the back of your mind already, what the replacement for a trade is going to be for that client before you start those negotiations.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to do. But what I'm trying to get at is to get really actionable advice at the firm level, because that's what we're talking about. So you need to talk to your clients, but you also need to engage your workforce.
And the workforce in this instance really is the sales and relationship managers. So they're the guys that are going to pick up the phone. Once they understand that universe of trades, they are the guys that are going to pick up the phone to the clients. Yeah. And the clients in this instance could even be other banks, though most of the other banks have signed up to the fallback. So in terms of bank-to-bank conversations, you pick up the phone where a trade will not naturally transition. So where you've just got a difficult legacy trade, right? You've both signed up to the fallback, but for whatever reason, the trade cannot transition. That's when you want to pick up the phone to another bank.
To sum it up, can you walk us through, in summary, the three alternatives that are now offered, that are available?
So the primary thing to do is to understand what trades you have in your portfolio. Some of those trades, you can leverage the fallback. Some of those trades will be fallen back for you, but other trades you will need to renegotiate with your clients. For those renegotiations, you'll be leveraging your sales and relationship management teams. So they will need to understand if a client has a swap in place, what potentially can be used to replace that swap, what RFR product could be used to replace that swap. And as I say, those negotiations are primarily there because one party has not signed up to the ISDA protocol. So typically the client will not have signed up to the ISDA protocol because they either don't really understand what the LIBOR transition is about, or really they just don't want to transition. They've got a perfectly adequate hedge and they want to keep it. So the job of the RM and the sales team in that instance will be to explain to the client why they can no longer hold on to their old LIBOR product and why this new RFR product is a perfectly sensible replacement that is equitable and fit for purpose. So that is really a business decision. Yeah. So all of the background work to that will have been done. The ability to price those products will have been done already. So it is a business conversation between the bank and the client. But if we move on beyond that, we've got some activities around trades that can leverage these ISDA fallback that we need to do. So I guess the ISDA fallback trades are effectively broken down into two categories. So cleared trades, so trades that are cleared through CCPs like the LCH and CME, will be automatically replaced in the middle of May next year. Your old LIBOR trades will be cancelled and you'll be given an RFR replacement. So the CCPs will ensure that these trades are economically equivalent by maintaining the last reset period prior to cessation and by providing a compensation, which is the difference between the old LIBOR product and the new RFR product. And the CCPs will give us plenty of time to test this process. They will schedule dress rehearsals throughout the first quarter next year, but they are optional. It is down to each individual bank to load the test environments at the CCP with test trades just to make sure that your process is working. So I think we should expect those trades, as I say, to be transitioned mid-May 2023. But as the transitions themselves that are cancellations of old trades and issuances of new trades, all the trade references are going to be new. So any, for example, if we look at hedge relationships, you may have hedge relationships set up on the basis of trade references. They're all going to need to be realigned. So if you just think of the impact on your existing positions and processes for having a new trade reference, that is what you need to consider. So one organization we went to, for example, all of those hedge relationships needed to be, I guess, realigned to the trades because all of the trade references were now new. Okay. But as well as getting a replacement swap, the CCPs will also give you what they call sort of an overlay swap. This is a swap that ensures the continuance of LIBOR until the end of the reset period that was in existence at cessation. Now, there is an impact on that in that you now have not only the replacement swap, so you've got a notional for the replacement swap, but you also have an equivalent notional for that overlay swap that just makes sure that LIBOR continues to the period beyond the cessation. So the impact of that is you now have double the notionals you thought you were going to have. You have the replacement swap plus this new swap that is there really just for mechanics, right? It's not there as part of your position as such. But nevertheless, if you just blindly take dumps out of your trading system, the notionals are going to look like they've increased. So you need to be aware of this before you do any sort of shareholder reporting, that your notionals haven't really increased in terms of those additional trades that you're getting from the CCPs. Now, in terms of the bilateral trades with fallback adherence, this should be reasonably straightforward. The process for managing fallback valuations in systems should already be in place following the non-US dollar transitions. There may be some model updates for USD-specific products, but it really is the additional USD volumes that are going to require attention. So I think the trick there is to make sure you get the model in place first and then performance test your fallback process, including all of the US dollar fallback updates as well, because that is going to put serious strain on your fallback calculations.
Implementing and testing, adjusting the reporting and all of that, which seems like quite mind-blowing from an external perspective. The firms have a lot of work on their hands.
Again, a lot of this will have already been done for the non-US dollar work. You just need to confirm that it's still going to work when you inject all of those USD volumes. That's the trick with this one. For example, we know some organizations that when the sterling CCP transition happened, they had real problem processing all of those cessations and rebookings over the window available. So let's say the process started on a Friday evening and the CCP sent through a load of cancellations and rebookings over that weekend. Some of the organizations had trouble actually processing those cancellations and rebookings in their systems. Now, US dollar volumes are much higher. So are you going to have enough time over that weekend to process all of the resulting cancellations and rebookings? So it's the impact of the additional volumes that really need to be in the forefront.
So I think no complacency sounds like the key word after listening to you. And may I also ask, so how does Brinkendon fit into that, and how do you help firms through this process?
I think we help because we understand where these bear traps are. We can understand where to focus attention, what test cycles to participate in, what test cycles you probably need in the first place as well. And because I think you may find organizations that don't really see a value in retesting their fallback processes. We would think that was a mistake. You may find some organizations that feel they don't need to participate in the CCP dress rehearsals. Again, we think that would be a mistake. The process is largely the same. There are some tweaks there. There are some manual interventions you can make this time around that will certainly de-risk the CCP transitions, but everything there is still worth testing.
And in practical terms, how do you work with those counterparts? Is it essentially consulting and guiding them on what needs to do? Or is there also a more like hands-on approach?
This has been quite hands-on historically. Because these transitions tend to reach throughout an organization, it really is the coordination of those teams that is key. So we typically are parachuted in to organize the teams, to explain what the impacts are, and to explain what their own responsibility given that impact as well. So it's traditional project management, if you like. It really is just managing the troops to address these challenges.
So you intervene for a set amount of time or for a specific mission, and you're like coordinating the different teams. Is that what the key aspect of your role?
If you think of a normal project, we will come in, we will understand what the outcome of that project needs to be, how that project impacts the different teams in the organization. There is nothing different here as well. We know we have a deadline to adhere to. We know the different teams that are going to be impacted by this change. We're parachuted in typically to make sure that happens, to make sure that those deadlines are met, to make sure that all of the impacts have been considered by all of the teams, so that we just have a nice, clean transition at the end of all of this. There are other dimensions there as well, because we can bring certain activities forward. We can make the whole process a lot more efficient by understanding how the pieces of that jigsaw do fit together. But effectively, really, this is just project management. This is really just good planning once you understand what the impacts can be.
And this is something, this is a kind of a project or a theme, or let's call it a topic, that Brick and Done has built as a core competency or as a specialty. Is that something that you've been through many times in the previous part of the transition?
It is. So this is something Brick and Done as an organization have worked on a few times now for the non-US dollar transitions. So we understand for different organizations where the impacts will be. And they're not, it's not consistent. There are different impacts for different organizations, but we understand, you know, where the failings are going to be. We understand how to make this a success for different organizations, different sizes of organizations as well. There are very definite sort of challenges with this, and the timing is one. Right. If you just consider that halfway through this whole process, we're going to have sort of a Christmas and a year end, it really means that in 2023, you don't actually have much time to do this. You need to be mobilized all of your troops now in order to get the heavy lifting done before we hit that Christmas and New Year period. Because after that, you've really got 4 months until the first transitions are forced on you. As we've said, those CCP transitions are going to start in May. Right. So at that point, you're going to have transition trades coming your way, come what may. So you don't have much time. You don't have much time in 2023 at all to do much other than testing.
And I'm just going to mention it here because it's something I've been meaning to say before. When we talk about CCP, we talk about Central Counterparty Clearinghouse. So you painted a very good picture of what needs to be done. What is your outlook based on that? How do you see this evolving?
So I think at the moment, for example, the CCP plans are developing. You've got to stay close to this. I don't think there will be any surprises there. But for example, we can see CME aligning much more closely to the LCH sort of non-US dollar plans. So the way they're doing things is going to be slightly different to last time. We do have a tentative timeline, and it is suggesting that transitions will take place from the beginning of May to the middle of May. That's why it's important to stay close to this. It is a slightly movable feast at the moment. I think the dress rehearsals that run alongside of the CCP transitions are likely to kick off from about March time. Again, stay close to these. You've got to decide what trades you're going to test through that process. And I think really with the CCP one, you're going to be given guidance by the end of August. So as long as you keep in touch with them, they will tell you what to do and when. Now, I guess we did hear, as I alluded to earlier, of organizations that struggled to process the GBP CCP transitions in the window available. So review your portfolio. If the USD transition is a notable step up in volume for you, then prepare accordingly. Because you, as I say, this happens over a single weekend. They will transition all of your US dollar trades. You will get, let's say you have 10,000 US dollar trades that need transitioning. You'll get 10,000 cancellations and 10,000 rebookings of the trade, 10,000 overlay swaps. That's an awful lot of processing over the weekend. This needs to be up and running on Monday morning. So the US dollar volumes are massively pertinent to this. Yeah. Now, one way of de-risking that is that there was a process in the non-US dollar transitions of splitting out basis swaps. This was really just to make sure they all go through the same cookie cutter process at the CCP. So when they actually come to the transition window, all of those basis swaps can go through that process as well. I think at the moment, the planning seems to suggest they will do that a couple of weeks. It will be enforced on you, let's say, a couple of weeks prior to the primary transition. But the H appear to be giving you the opportunity to run that process yourself an earlier date, to run that splitting out of your basis swaps at an earlier date. So I would suggest that is a good thing to bag.
We follow closely what the central clearing counterparties are doing, and they'll be communicating, but it's something that you need to be, well, attentive, if not proactive about.
Yeah, so that's all from a sort of a CCP perspective. I think we've already said from a client outreach perspective, you need to be on that already. If you're not doing it now, then you're behind the curve. So you need to identify the trades, You need to pick up the phone to the counterparts. You need to be negotiating those trades with those counterparts. And that's no mean feat. These are not all just simple swaps that can be restructured, renegotiated easily. Some of these are quite complex. And the reason that you're renegotiating isn't because your counterpart hasn't signed up to the fallback. No, it's because these trades actually can't transition. So you need to really put your thinking hat on about what you're going to do with those trades. So that's the client transition. But if we think about the fallback process itself, you've got a lot of trades going through this process at the moment. For those that perhaps unfamiliar with the process, the fallback process for a lot of people was all about keeping the IBOR trade as an IBOR trade in your system. And for the fallback process that you've developed to look at that trade and say, LIBOR doesn't exist anymore. So I need to price this using a different rate. I need to reprice this using one of the RFR rates instead. So that opens up a whole can of worms, right? One of them is that you're going to be putting a lot of trades through your fallback process. At the moment, you've got yen, euros, Swissy, and sterling going through that fallback calculator. You're going to have all those US dollar trades on top of that. You have to consider whether that is still going to be performant. So for your overnight processing, are you still going to be able to revalue all of those trades and hit your SLAs the next? I think that's quite a big deal. Appreciate that everything is scalable and you can rescale your cloud computing solution to do that, but you need to consider that. Also, I think around that fallback process, if we consider, for example, that the trade may still look like a LIBOR trade in your systems, and you may well have put in some workarounds in your settlements process that maybe realign your reset notice periods or something along those lines. And that process may well have worked for a smaller population, a sterling population. Will that manual process still work for a much larger population of trade? If you had problems that weren't resolved as part of the non-US dollar transition, fix those now. Fix those while the sun is shining, because you don't want your population of manual workarounds to increase through this. Perhaps the other things I could suggest would be to start running compression cycles at the latest sort of early 2023. You know, that will reduce the volume of trades that are going to be transitioned by the CCPs. It will reduce the volume of trades that you're going to push through your fallback process. Anything you can do to collapse the number of trades that you're processing is going to help. And I think that's where my focus would be at this point in time.
An impressive amount of work, of things to do. And I think we've got a very complete picture now. To conclude, as it's such a project management, I mean, it's the archetype of project management, what's the most, let's say, exciting thing about this?
So other than the challenge itself, which is exciting, regulatory programs are always exciting, have definite defined timelines and go live dates. I think the IBOR experience will have given banks the opportunity to refine their enterprise program management process. So my advice would be embed what you've learned, warts and all. This is priceless information for your enterprise program management process. We don't have too many of these changes that reach into every nook and cranny of an organization. So take this opportunity to understand where your engagements with downstream teams worked well, where they didn't work well, what you did to work around them. It will pay you dividends when it comes to the next big change.
You can really transform this regulatory change into an opportunity. I think that's a very good conclusion. And thank you so much for all your advice and your insight into this momentous change that's affecting the industry. And perhaps not everyone or people who are not fully involved with are aware of, but this is, we mentioned it, a multi-trillion dollar process. And I just want to wish you all the best with all the work. And thank you very much for your time, Alan.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the Financial Markets Insights podcast by the Realization Group. Please subscribe to stay informed of all future episodes.